This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the latest developments in U.S. immigration policy today. Later, we're going to be getting into what's happening with DACA, the end of temporary protected status for some Central American countries, travel bans, and other issues. But first, the city of San Antonio is one of 11 cities taking part in the Safe Cities Initiative. San Antonio will fund defense of immigrants going through deportation process. To find out more about this, we're joined by Maria Villagomez, the assistant city manager for the city of San Antonio, and Liz Provencio. She is a first assistant city attorney for the city of San Antonio. It's great to have you here. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Maria, tell me more. How did San Antonio connect with the Safe Cities Initiative? That SAFE stands for Safety and Fairness for Everyone Cities. Tell us more about that.
That is correct, and thank you for having us on your show. Well, just a little bit of background. Back in March of 2017, one of our council members, Councilman Saldana, asked city staff to come up with some options to provide information, education, and legal representation to the immigrant community here in San Antonio. At the same time, he also made us aware of this opportunity with the Vera Institute of Justice for a potential grant. So in May of 2017, we presented to the City Council some options and also asked the Council for some direction to submit a letter of interest, which we got approval to do so. And through that process, we applied for funding through the Vera Institute of Justice to get some consideration to get some other grants for us to be able to provide legal representation to the immigrant community. We were awarded $100,000, and with the award, we were also became part of this Safe Cities Network. As you mentioned, there are 11 jurisdictions across the country who are members of this circle. And with the dollars provided from VERA, our legal providers that we contracted through a procurement process that include Raices, Catholic Charities, and American Gateways, we will be able to provide legal representation to those individuals that need the assistance, up to those that are facing deportation. So that's how we came about to receive the grant from VERA.
How does this work? How does the city of San Antonio, so you can't, so you're getting the money, also the city of San Antonio is putting money in. How much money is San Antonio putting in?
So the dollars that come from the Vera Institute of Justice, they go directly to the legal providers. So the $100,000 that I describe go directly to Raices, Catholic Charities, and American Gateways. The city of San Antonio approved a budget of $150,000 to provide legal representation not only to those individuals needing assistance with immigration services, but also to homeless individuals that needed ID recovery assistance, some of our veterans and some of our seniors. So of the $150,000, $100,000 was allocated to immigration legal services, and then $50,000 of the city's money, again, to veteran issues, homeless, landlord-tenant, and simple wills for seniors.
Liz Provencio, first assistant city attorney for the city of San Antonio. When does the defense begin? When does these services kick off for these immigrants going through deportation?
Good afternoon. Thank you. Well, the defense, if you're talking about the process in terms of where it kicks in, the services that are being provided include the ability to be able to provide affirmative representation, which is before there's any proceeding in place. And there's also money available as a result of VERA's funding to provide representation for those that are already in proceedings. So anything from information sessions on the front end to those that are seeking information and, you know, who we would like to be able to have more information about all the options available to them, to those that are already in deportation proceedings or some type of removal proceeding, may be assisted through this funding as well.
And that's already happening, or that's about to come?
Yes, sir, that's already happening.
Now, how do you decide which immigrant is going to receive these services? Is there a means test to see what their income level is? Also, do you look to see if they have a criminal record? Does that come into the play?
The short answer is yes. And our service providers, both through the criteria provided through VERA as well as criteria that we've enumerated for them based on the policy priorities of our council, will have an evaluation process. But all of the funds are only available to those that are considered low income.
And what about the criminal record part of that?
Yes, criminal record does come into play. There is a priority for those and there's a requirement, actually, that all those that are served either be San Antonio residents or have ties to San Antonio family members. And we've got issues that may come up as a result of victims that are of domestic violence or trafficking victims. And so to the extent that there may be overlay with criminal allegations, with their involvement, those, you know, may be considered, but they may also receive some representation. But there is priorities for those that are without criminal records.
Now, how long do you expect these funds to last? You think this will get you through the entire year, or how does that, what do you think?
The way we've allocated the funds and the way that VERA intends to disperse the funds is that it will be over the course of a year. Our providers are working with us and with VERA jointly to be sure that the way they're expended is over the course of the year.
Now, New York City is also part of the Safe Cities initiatives, and there's been reporting that showed that prior to joining us and being able to provide these services to their residents going through deportation, at the time they had 2% of people not being deported, and now it's almost 50% because of providing this service. So evidently being able to provide a legal defense in immigration court does make a difference on the outcomes. Are you expecting similar outcomes here, Maria Villagomez?
We do. And, you know, one of the reasons why the city of San Antonio is providing the services, our goal is to keep San Antonio safe and families together. To the extent, for instance, if a parent of a U.S. citizen who happens to be undocumented and needs assistance by, one, knowing that they are eligible for the information, so we're doing some education workshops through Catholic Charities so they're aware of their rights, and number two, and also offering the legal representation through an attorney, we'll be able to keep that family together. So, yes, we are expecting to see similar results to what the city of New York has seen so far.
And last question really quickly, how do people access this service? Do they have to request it, or is this something that the city is aggressively providing?
We are aggressively providing through our legal providers. So as I mentioned, both American Gateways and Catholic Charities are providing educational workshops, and then the three entities are providing legal representation.
Well, thank you all very much. Thank you for joining us. The City of San Antonio is joining the Safe Cities Initiative, providing defense for immigrants going through deportation here in San Antonio. And we're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to continue our conversation talking more about immigration in the U.S. The number to call is 210-614-8980. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We continue our conversation about changes happening to the U.S. immigration system and how this impacts members of our community. Our phone lines are open, and you can call in, tell us what you're dealing with, if it's happening to your life or maybe someone in your family. The number is 210-614-8980, and email us at thesource@tpr.org, tweet us at tprsource. We're joined now by Erica Schomer. She is a clinical assistant professor at St. Mary's University School of Law. Rogelio Sainz, dean of the College of Public Policy at the University of Texas at San Antonio. And Justice Tulias is the Associate Executive Director for the RAICES, Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services. Welcome, all of y'all. It's great to have you here. So, Eric, let me go to you first here. And can you tell me how I'm going to look at this? This is really is interest to me is how this temporary protected status is ending for Central American countries. What is temporary protected status, and why is it going away?
So, temporary protected status, or TPS, is something that can be granted by the federal government to individuals from certain countries when there has been a natural disaster, there's some sort of situation going on in the home country where it would not be safe for people to have to return.
So it's a humanitarian program.
It is a humanitarian program.
And we saw a lot of it come from when Hurricane Mitch hit the Central American countries.
Yes. So for when we're talking about Central America, Hurricane Mitch was the impetus for TPS being designated for Nicaragua and Honduras. And then earthquakes in El Salvador in 2001 led to TPS designation for El Salvador, also for Haiti, which was one of the more recent TPS designations that was made. A couple weeks ago, on November 6th, Acting Secretary of Homeland Security announced that they would eliminate the TPS designation for Nicaragua. That has been extended for 12 months, and so as of January 5th, 2019, Nicaraguans who hold TPS will no longer have status. That same day, she announced that she needs 6 more months to consider conditions in Honduras and whether or not TPS will be extended for about 57,000 Honduran nationals.
San Antonio has a considerable population of people from Central America, doesn't it?
It does.
And how would this impact San Antonio? Do we know?
Well, I don't have the specific numbers for San Antonio, but certainly we do have Honduran and Salvadoran nationals living in San Antonio and people with family members. Nicaragua, we're talking about a relatively small number of people, but as I said, Honduras, there's 57,000. And for El Salvador, there are about 200,000 individuals nationwide that have TPS. And the current TPS designation for El Salvador will expire on March 9th of 2018. So that means by the latest, the first or second week of January of 2018, there'll have to be an announcement about whether or not El Salvador will be redesignated as well.
Honduras, 25% of their gross national product comes from remittances sent to there from the people in the United States who are here legally, who are working under TPS. How would that shake up Honduras in order to do that, and how would that be impact our overall immigration system?
Honduras is desperately poor. I think to someone who doesn't know, you can talk about a storm happening in 1999 and say, well, how can that possibly still have an impact on the country? But the statistics actually show that that storm set the country back at least 20 years.
You can still see the damage when you're in Tegucigalpa of the storm. And ending TPS would have huge repercussions for their economy. Rogelio Sainz at UTSA, any numbers about how big the Central American population is in San Antonio? Any ideas?
I don't have their numbers right off with me, but I would say probably we're talking about 8,000 or so might be
I see specialty stores serving Central American customers, population, scattered around San Antonio. I imagine if there's enough to set up a Central American grocery market, a couple of them are on the west side, I figure, well, there must be a population.
Right. I think that, and you're absolutely right, the restaurants that we see and a variety of other activities as well. And we also have in places like Houston, for example, a very, very significant Central American population that has been there all the way back to the 1970s, where you really had the uprooting of many people as civil wars were going on.
Our phone number to call in if you've got a question or a comment as we talk about changes happening to our immigration system. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Josh has called in. And, Josh, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Well, first off, I think it's not proper for the people living in San Antonio to have to pay their tax money to support people who entered the United States illegally or overstayed their visas.
All right, Josh, thank you for that. So, Justin Tullius, you're with RAICES, and your organization will be receiving some of the funds to help take San Antonio into this Safe Cities initiatives. Josh is probably speaking for many people in our community saying, why is the city of San Antonio paying for these to provide defense for those who are going through deportation? Go ahead.
Well, I think one of the things that really emerged from our city officials who were speaking a little bit earlier is the New York experience. And it is true, when the New York City Council started stepping in to provide this universal representation for folks from New York who lived in New York long-term, had families there, the success rate of their cases in immigration court went up by 1,100%. And I think to step back and look at where we're coming from here, it's really intuitive to all of us that if anyone's in a criminal court, if they are going through a criminal charge process, they're innocent until proven guilty, and we have a constitutional right to have a lawyer beside somebody to give them a fair shake at justice.
Well, even Josh's question, he says they're here illegally in the United States. They're criminals, he said, but they're not going through criminal court proceedings. This is a civil court.
That's right. In our immigration system, there is no right to that lawyer. So we have children who face an immigration judge alone every day here in San Antonio with no lawyer. We have moms and dads from all around the San Antonio area who also go through that process. And going back to the questioner's good question, I think, about the economics and what's in the best interest of a city, we see devastating economic facts effects on families who have a mom or dad who goes through that detention process of fighting their immigration case. Jobs are lost, children fail out of school. I can think of numerous clients that I've sat across the table from in detention myself this year. And those are the kind of effects that it's in the best interest of a city to really try and alleviate. Many of those children are U.S. citizens, and it really harms the city overall when you have folks who have lived in San Antonio, raised families here for decades, who don't have that basic fair shake at justice by having a lawyer by their side to navigate the very complex system.
If you've, I'm sure, you know, Justin, you've been through immigration court here in San Antonio, how quickly the immigration judge has to go through these cases. It is just, they speak in this high-octane shorthand of legalese and acronyms for paperwork. It's really difficult to follow. And if you're not an English speaker, and some of these people going through this process are 9, 10, 11 years old, there's no way that any individual can keep up with what they're going through, and their lives are in the balance. So it seems like all some people are asking for is a fairness to provide someone with some expertise to provide to help people going through this process.
That's right. And I think when, again, you look at the New York experience and you look at what this network of 11 cities is embarking on, this really is cities saying, look, this is a fairness issue. We need legal support for as much the U.S. citizen children of folks who may be going through the process as anyone. And I'm just thinking back to a recent case where I represented a gentleman in detention. He had no idea how to navigate his case. He was detained for 2 or 3 months. And his son, born right here in Texas, wrote a letter to the judge and said, I miss playing basketball with my dad. I don't understand if he can get out. He doesn't understand. We were able to work with the gentleman. He was released, and now he's working his way through his case to towards legal status, which he really qualifies for under the laws that Congress made.
Another big item that's happening with immigration today in the news is DACA. And can we get an update on where we are with DACA, Erica Schomer, with the St. Mary's School of Law?
Yes. So on September 5th of this year, President Trump announced that the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program would be phased out. So there was a 30-day deadline for people to file for renewal if their DACA status expired on or before March 5th of 2018. That deadline is come and gone, and basically the administration put the ball in Congress's court and said we need Congress needs to act to try and create a permanent path to citizenship for people who qualify for DACA. So right now, there are five different bills pending in Congress. There's a DREAM Act from 2017, and then there are some different bills pending that also would provide some sort of remedy to people who were brought here when they were young. But thus far, none of them have progressed very far, and we haven't seen any votes.
There is some issue with the mail system that some DACA applications are going to be rejected, or at least that was a story that came out, because the mail service was slow and they're being considered, these applications will not be considered. So, Justin Tullius, can you tell us more about that?
Yes, we organized to quickly support as many DACA recipients as we could when that announcement came out from the administration, giving a really draconian one-month deadline to get the paperwork together.
And get the money.
The money, the $495 fee. We met numerous people here in San Antonio, all around South Texas, who are hardworking DACA recipients, and that month deadline was very, very hard for many people to meet, who are raising kids, who have their own families.
So people were dropping it in the mailbox thinking they got that postmark stamped and that would be good, but apparently that wasn't good enough for those receiving the applications. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And so you had folks who did scramble to get that money together in the documents. They got the application in the mail, but what we've documented is that numerous applications arrived to USCIS, the government agency that grants DACA, but then the agency did not then check its own mail in time to check in those applications by its deadline. And that's what we're really working to advocate for them to accept so that these folks can continue their two-year protection.
So is that being litigated, or how is that working?
Right now, we've received some initial guidance from the government saying that they'll accept those. And I think all of us who practice here, Erica included, can speak to this. We're working to reach as many folks as we can who had that issue and make those arguments that the applications should be accepted.
Erica?
Yeah, there was an announcement that the government is going to accept those applications if you can demonstrate basically that your application was there. But it's going to be, frankly, a bit of a mess to figure out because immigration goes by a received by deadline for all of its applications. So it's always extremely important not to show just that you postmarked it by October 5th. That was not the deadline. It had to be received by. And so I think we're going to have to see how the process actually works for the individuals who do have proof. And some of the cases, these applications were mailed weeks before that deadline and still didn't get picked up by the service.
And Erica, have you heard from anyone who's in a limbo zone because they don't know if their application made it in time? They're kind of on edge. How are people dealing with that?
In our clinic, we don't personally have any clients whose applications weren't received. But I think the people who we've heard from who are really in limbo are actually the people whose status is expiring just after that March 5th, 2018 deadline. You know, they're terrified. They don't know what's going to happen. And honestly, they don't really have faith that our congressional representatives are going to give the fix that they need in time for them to be able to maintain their lawful status.
And I guess that prediction would be based upon the performance that we've had so far from Congress, not really being able to pass much legislation and get it signed. We're going to take a break. Our phone lines are open. We want to hear from our community. This is a community conversation as we talk about what's happening with immigration policy today. The number to call in is 210-614-8980. Tell us your personal stories. How is this impacting you? How have you seen this impacting the local community? The number to call in, 210-614-8980. We're talking about immigration on The Source today. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the latest developments in U.S. immigration policy today. That includes what's happening with DACA, the end of the temporary protected status for some Central American countries, the travel ban, other issues, including changes to our legal immigration system. There's a lot of changes happening there. If you've got a question or a comment, give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Rogelio Sines, Dean of the College of Public Policy at the University of Texas at San Antonio. Rogelio, we're seeing that unemployment is at a record low. It's the lowest it's been in decades, below 4% here in Texas. And I'm hearing that we need workers. I was at the Texas coast this weekend interviewing people regards to Hurricane Harvey recovery. The complaint I heard most often from the employers, people would they don't have any workers. Mm-hmm. They need workers.
Yep. And I think that's one of the things that we often hear in terms of people who want to stop immigration and so forth, is that immigrants are taking jobs away from American citizens. But as we saw here in San Antonio, for example, I think it was announced today, the lowest unemployment rate in some time. And that's a similar thing that is going on here in the state of Texas. You talk about the issue having to do with hurricane recovery. We saw that taking place way back when Katrina took place. And immigrants were very instrumental in coming to New Orleans and rebuilding the city. And there's going to be a massive need for that labor, which immigrants have traditionally provided. And not only do you see it in terms of the hurricane recovery, but even around our community, for example, you go to a lot of restaurants where there's short-staffed jobs that typically immigrants and people with low levels of education have filled those jobs. So there's a massive need. And if you cut immigration or you send people back, it's going to have a major impact on the community as well as state and nation.
Go to the phone lines with Kirby. And Kirby, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I only have a comment, and I was just listening to that guy talk about the shortage. I have some friends, I'm not going to say where they're from, but they're trying to get into the United States, which is kind of a hard, difficult road to go. My only complaint about everything is why can't we fix it where it's fair for everyone that's trying to get in our country? You know, that's my only complaint. I don't have any problem with anything else. I just think it would be nice if everybody is trying, which is probably a million people a day trying to get in our country, just to do it. Everybody has to do it the same way. That's all. That's right. My only comment.
Kirby, thank you for that comment. We appreciate it. Erica Schaumer with the St. Mary's School of Law. We do know that President Trump has a RAISE Act, which would be the biggest change in 50 years to the legal immigration system. He wants to get rid of the lottery system, and he wants to switch to a quote-unquote merit-based system similar to used in Australia and Canada, and one that would favor those who speak English. So that's the system that we're moving towards, right? That they want to move towards.
That's correct. That's what the RAISE Act intends to do, is kind of change the rules about who can come and how we make those determinations.
And how would that look different than the system that we know now?
So right now we have a system that basically provides humanitarian benefits for asylum seekers and refugees, family-based benefits for relatives of U.S. citizens and lawful permanent residents, and then we have employment-based benefits. And what the new legislation proposes to do is decrease the number of people allowed in as refugees, decrease by a lot the number of people allowed to come in under family with family members, and cut out a lot of categories. And then the employment-based system, instead of being kind of based on different visas that each have their own requirements, would go to a point-based system. And that point-based system, as outlined in the act, really increases, it puts an emphasis on higher levels of education, on people who speak English well, on people who are young. So it awards points based on your age, and the most points would come for people around the age of 25. So I guess the idea is to bring people when they're young and are going to be able to contribute to our workforce for the maximum period of time.
And then just out of college, they've already been educated.
Right. Also, giving preference to people in STEM fields and people who can invest at least $1.35 million in our economy.
Now that's very different than what we see today. And so let me ask you, Justin Tullius at RAISES, if the RAISE Act becomes law, how would that change what you see?
Well, I think what Erica pointed out is really the issue of what contributing to the economy means here for immigration. When you look at what immigrants who already live here invest in the economy, and going back to the dean's comments, what we work with so many times when we have a mom or dad in detention fighting their case to continue living here safely in the United States with their kids, we're working with letters from employers who are saying, please don't take this person away from their job. 33% of DACA recipients in Texas bought a car after they received DACA status. So folks who live here are already contributing to a huge degree to our economy. And I think what we're looking at is a system that bars so many of these moms and dads and family members from any way forward right here that they can apply for in the United States.
So we had an email from Tino, and he asked, can we talk about the potential economic impact of deporting the DACA recipients? Has anyone done a study looking at that, Rogelio Sainz from UTSA?
I'm not aware of a particular study that has done that, but you can imagine the extent to which we stand to lose a significant amount of income, a significant amount of taxes that people are paying. And
so, intellectual capital, because a lot of these DACA recipients, they have gone through college.
Right.
I mean, you have contact with Dreamers at your school, at UTSA.
Exactly. I think what you have with the DACA program that that President Obama opened and provided opportunities for people to continue their education, to advance their academic skills and job skills, and also in better paying jobs that allow them to be consumers who are paying more, spending more, and also paying more taxes. These are individuals that many of these are individuals who are professional and so forth. And we stand to lose that particular capital that they have. And one of the ironic things is that our country has also invested significantly in educating these individuals because they came at a very early age. So most of their public school K through 12 was here in the United States, as well as in colleges and universities.
And basically, we'll be aiding the competitiveness of our other nations that we compete against. They're
exactly.
going to benefit from that. All right, so let's go back to the phone lines. If you want to call in, the number is 210-614-8980, and you don't have to give your name or your real name. You can remain anonymous if you want to talk about what's happening to you and the immigration system. And Barbara is on the line. Barbara, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Well, my question has always been, and I've sent letters to this to everybody I could think of, is that I know a family that has three girls, and they came over when they were 1, 2, and 3, and they've been here since then in pre-K and all through the school systems, and I know these school districts kept money for that, and I feel like we've spent a whole lot of money on this already, and why on earth would we want to not take advantage of that investment that we've already made?
All right, Barbara, thank you for that call. And Erica, any thoughts?
Well, that's exactly right. And there are some statistics to go to the prior caller's question about what the economic impact would be. So an organization called the Interfaith Worker Justice Organization actually has a fact sheet by state that talks about the number of workers that would be lost and the economic impact. So, for example, in Texas, according to their study, if DACA is eliminated, 100,000 workers would be lost, and the economy would lose $6.3 billion. That's just the state of Texas. If you go to their website, you can look up and see the numbers state by state and nationwide. And I think the caller has a point that has been echoed by business leaders in the community that actually sent the administration and the congressional leaders a letter really demanding that some fix be made, because Google, Apple, Microsoft, all of these major corporations have workers with DACA status and have people that they don't want to lose. They don't want their workers to have to go back. And we have educated these people. It would be nonsensical. The money's already been spent. They've already achieved the educational benefit. And then we're going to send them back to some other country where they might be able to have an impact, but it might also be reduced because they might not have those job opportunities for them to contribute in their home country.
If a person is They are a dreamer from Mexico, and they come to the United States, and then they get deported back to Mexico. I mean, what is the nature of their citizenship in Mexico? Because I know Mexico is very sensitive about, are you a Mexican or not? It can be complicated, Rogelio.
Yeah, I believe that being, let's say that someone is born in Mexico, then that they are a Mexican citizen. The issue is, I think, that where individuals, that their only country that they know is in the United States. So I've had young people that have talked to me that have been deported, where all of a sudden it's really going into a foreign country where they don't know the language, that they get made fun, bullied, and so forth, because they're seen as outsiders and so forth. So people that are in a completely new, different environment. And just the fact that many of those are individuals that are separated from their families who are here in the United States and loved ones plays a major toll in their lives as well.
Okay, we'll talk more about that when we come back from this break. Our phone line is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. We're talking about, we're getting an update on the latest developments with the immigration system. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the immigration system in the United States going through lots of changes. We know they've started to scale back DACA. They want to end the temporary protected status for some Central American countries. The travel ban is still working its way through courts, and we've got other issues, including SB4 here in Texas. That's also hung up in the courts. If you got a question or comment, the number to call in is 210-614-8980. Lots of callers. And here's Sean. Sean, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a PhD candidate in medical sociology, and so I was wondering if you guys could talk a little bit about, because I'm not familiar with statistics here in Texas, but the health detriments that we're seeing with these immigrants, not just the effects of the fear and the anxiety and the stigma of being, of going through the status, but also the effects on the individual, to the family and the community, for avoiding these services. You know, they may have access to public services that they're avoiding. So how that's affecting the community with the overall health problems that we're now seeing, where people don't get access to certain resources.
Sean, thank you for that call. Justin Tullius is with us. He's the Associate Executive Director of the Refugee and Immigration Center for Education and Legal Services, also known as RIESIS. Justin.
Well, I think that's a great question, and that really goes back to the ability of families who live here in San Antonio to fully participate in our city in every way that we all need each other to. And going back to SB4, which is the state law that really sought to turn every local law enforcement officer into an immigration agent, going back to when the news of that came out, we started to already see a chilling effect with folks accessing basic services, public health services, school outreach events, WIC clinics. So we heard from our partners in those service providers saying, look, families are afraid to access us. They think that they're going to suffer detention, deportation, if they look for those basic services that their whole family needs. It wasn't true, but that was the message sent by a punitive law like SB4.
The caller, Alex. Alex, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
We have businesses here in San Antonio, and we lack employees. And why hasn't the government ever taken any emphasis in trying to do a paid visa based on merits? You do well, you pay your taxes, you're a good citizen, you renew every 2 years, every year, government pays their fees, their dues, and they get to stay. Economy grows with all the immigrants that are in the United States and allow family members to come in. We'll do the same. Everything's based on some type of fee. Government gets their money, and we get workers.
Alex, thank you for your call. Erica Schaumer with the St. Mary's University School of Law. Are things like that being considered?
Not currently, not with the RAISE Act. I think if anything, we're making it, it's getting harder. Certainly in all my years as an immigration attorney, I've talked to a lot of employers who want to legalize a worker that they have, who's a really great worker, who is instrumental to their business. And the fact of the matter is, the way our system is right now, once somebody is already here and they've either overstayed or maybe they came in without permission, It's nearly impossible for them to legalize their status to be able to stay on with an employer. I would encourage the caller and other business owners who have workers and feel that they don't have a path to get the workers that they need to reach out to their congressional representatives, meet with them, tell your story, tell them what you need, why you can't get workers, because only when elected officials are hearing from the people affected by this problem, are we going to have a real understanding based on the facts and the reality on the ground and not based on fear and this anti-immigrant rhetoric that doesn't really reflect our reality.
Rogelio Sines, Dean of the College of Public Policy at University of Texas at San Antonio. We are seeing all these anti-immigration policies come about in Texas and from Washington, D.C. We're told that we have an immigration crisis in America, an illegal immigration crisis. Do we?
No. I think that the economy amply illustrates the fact that the United States still has major economic needs and that immigrants are filling those needs. The United States demographically is also, as we've seen, the baby boomers are reaching retirement age. We're going to have a major labor shortage coming up in the next decade and a half. And it is these particular immigrants and immigrant children today that are going to provide those needs. I think another element that is always put across is that immigrants are also criminals and so forth, and there's major work by sociologists, University of Chicago, Northeastern University, that show that immigrants, Latino immigrants, are less likely to commit crimes compared to other groups, something that we've seen since the last century in terms of immigrants coming to the United States.
Another caller, Chris, has called in. Hi, Chris. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, guys. I was just considering this conversation about requiring our immigrants to have college education or higher skilled positions available to them. Isn't that just a little bit counterintuitive if we're trying to make sure that our better paid jobs aren't taken from our American citizens? When in reality, what we really need is the semi-skilled and the non-skilled labor.
Okay, Chris, thank you for that. And Erica Schalmer?
I think that's exactly right. If you buy into the rhetoric that immigrants are stealing jobs, it seems like the nativists would want the good jobs to go to the U.S. citizens. And I think the prior caller who was talking about a labor shortage, he didn't say, but I would imagine that probably is for unskilled labor. And that is the area where our system as it is already severely limits the number of unskilled people who can come in. There are some visas available for agricultural workers, but they're very, very limited. And, you know, there's been numerous instances of farmers complaining that they have crops rotting in the fields because they don't have workers to pick them. And so, you know, it would make sense to actually look at what our economic needs are. What are the jobs that Americans are not willing to do? That's usually where the employers come in and say, I would love to hire an American citizen. Nobody will do this job. And build our new immigration system on that, on meeting the needs of the fields that we don't have American citizens to do those jobs. And, you know, look at our educational system about how we educate the people who are here to have the high-skilled jobs.
So, Justin Tullius over at RIESIS, you provide legal defense for many people who are being deported and who are coming across and may not be here with legal status. What are their expectations for employment?
Well, I think one thing that's interesting to think about is to Erica's point, you know, there's two groups of people that we see regularly in our offices who are devastated when they hear about the reality of who can immigrate or who has a route to legal status permanently once they're already here, even if they've come here as a young child at age one or two and don't remember any other country. Those two groups are U.S. citizen spouses and U.S. employers. And so both employers and spouses who consult with us are devastated to find out that our system is broken, that for an employer, as Erica said, there's very limited way, if any, that most employers could ever legalize a vital employee to their business. And one thing I think we have work to do as lawyers is to educate the community, tell lawmakers about the provisions that Congress put into the immigration system back in the 90s that broke that system. And that took away the line to stand in for so many thousands of U.S. citizens, spouses of U.S. citizens, so many employees, so that these families really are devastated when they find out what the limitations are on any way forward for them.
Rogelio Sáenz, we always hear that. The system is broken. Immigration system is broken. And so it seems like no one ever asked, why is the system broken? How did it get broken? We heard that a little bit from Justin. But it seems like you're telling me that the perception that people have about the immigration reality is very different than what is actually happening at the border, mm-hmm. in our job sites, and our immigration courtrooms. And people are being fed a lot of misinformation about what's going on. They're being whipped up into a frenzy, and now we can't get anything done. Is that what's happening?
Exactly. So you hear many people talk about, well, when my ancestors came, they went through it legally and so forth. But that was an extremely different entry system where it was much more efficient. Now you have individuals that even if they try to go legally through the system, we're talking about 25, 30 years that they have to wait in line. So that's part of that the system that is broken right now.
And Erica Schomer at the St. Mary's University School of Law, you're looking at the Dreamers dealing with DACA. They're in a limbo. What are they telling you? How are they feeling? What are you telling them?
The Dreamers are scared. I mean, there's a lot of young people who are in college right now, and some of them are there because they either work part-time jobs, which helps them go to school, or they have work-study benefits. And if their work permit expires, they're not going to be eligible to work anymore and help pay for their education. So we're seeing, you know, young people who are really scared. We also have had numerous reports of DACA holders traveling in Texas up from the border area, from the Rio Grande Valley and from Laredo, getting stopped and fingerprinted at the checkpoints.
Eye scanned as well.
Yes. And there are a couple DACA recipients who are detained in Pearsall right now. So we have been advising students that they shouldn't travel to the border area where they would have to go through inspection, even if their DACA is valid, because there's a risk. You never know what could happen. If they get a rogue official, they could end up in detention, and it's not worth it.
And Justin, we got 30 seconds. You wanted to cap that off?
I think that's a great point, and I think community defense is more important than ever. For those young people with DACA, they need to organize, talk to their friends and supporters, and prepare a defense using publicity and public pressure if they need it.
And also now the city of San Antonio is part of the Safe Cities, and they're able to provide some defense in the immigration court. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thank you so much for tuning us in.